Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Ann R. Williams, and she is the general editor of the brand new National Geographic book, Treasures of Egypt, A Legacy in Photographs from the Pyramids to Cleopatra. The book's available everywhere, and since it is a National Geographic book, the photography is otherworldly. It's second to none, as all Nat Geo stuff is. But and jumping into this, the whole idea of ancient Egypt, so much of it is so foreign to us, not just because it is a foreign country, but because it's something that seemed to can only take place there. We don't have this type of stuff in America where people are discovering buried treasures from centuries ago. Can you kind of set up, first of all, what a general editor for a project like this does?
Well, National Geographic, I was a staff writer at National Geographic magazine for almost 30 years, and I am an archaeologist by training, and I have come to specialize in ancient Egypt. So people, I'm retired from that position now, but people at National Geographic know that that is my specialty, and they had this idea for a beautiful coffee table book on ancient Egypt, and they came to me and they said, can you help us put this together? So part of my job was to come up with an outline that made sense, that would allow us to present photographs in a logical and compelling way, but also pair them with essays that would make the book a good read. And then I wrote a lot of that book. Now, some of the text is repurposed from other National Geographic publications, but most of that book I wrote myself. So this is really something that came out of my head. And I was working with a fabulous designer named David Griffin. And I've worked with him before. He and I worked many years together at the National Geographic magazine. And we had a lot of discussions about what photographs we were going to use and how we were going to use them and the order we were going to use them in and how we were going to pair them with these essays that I was writing and editing. So those are all the things that I did. Plus, everything that I wrote, everything that I edited, had to be sourced. In other words, so I turn this in, and there's a manuscript, but there's also a list of sources so that a fact checker can go back behind me and make sure that I got the dates right, I got the spelling right, I haven't misstated or misunderstood. So anyway, those are all the things that I did.
Well, you know, when I hear ancient Egypt, it's such an overwhelming term that it's hard to put your mind around the time periods that we're talking. And so at the beginning of the book, I know you have this timeline set out, and you kind of have it delineated as far as the years that we're talking about, all the way back to 3000 BC, which is just a remarkable time period to even think about. But as you look at artifacts from those time periods, is archaeological science certain enough that you think that these dates are probably correct, or is the science still working on this to try to further determine the time periods that all of these artifacts came from?
Well, I think both. Archaeological science has progressed a lot since the beginning of the field, and so a lot of the dates that you see on that timeline have been refined. But I would also say that there are new techniques coming along all the time that are allowing us to continue to refine that timeline. It is 3,000 years of history, and that is actually one of the very exciting things for those of us who follow Egyptology, that there are new discoveries and that great span of history of ancient Egypt is like a great jigsaw puzzle, and every time there's a new piece, we get very excited because even those of us who are amateurs can take that piece and try to fit it into this great jigsaw puzzle. What I have tried to do with this book is give people a guide through 3,000 years of ancient Egyptian history to kind of make it easy for people. It's kind of like a big, gorgeous cheat sheet.
it seems like so much of what we know about ancient Egypt is from these artifacts. And when archaeologists discover something, or somebody finds a piece, and you figure out what the time period's from, and you can tell I'm an amateur at this, by the way, I'm asking these questions, but is there any timeline to, or any written history to use to try to back up some of your thoughts and findings to match certain historical events that happened? I mean, what's the record keeping like from this time period of ancient Egypt?
Well, we have all sorts of sources. There are texts, and those help a lot. There are inscriptions on temples and in tombs. There are all sorts of artifacts. People study the way art changes. I mean, you can imagine in 3,000 years there were certain things that remained the same. You can look at something from the Old Kingdom, which is early, and look at something from the New Kingdom, which is much later, and you can see similarities, but you can also see how the art changed through time. It's sort of an evolving puzzle.
Of course, whenever you hear Egypt, everybody thinks of King Tut, and that was as far as my youth, the Steve Martin song was what brought that into the forefront. And
love that song. It makes me laugh every time. It was brilliant.
What a brilliant piece of culture for us to still enjoy today. But the discovery of King Tut's tomb, and was that, I mean, people, it's popular because I know it came and toured the United States in that time period, but how watershed was that moment when that tomb was discovered? How watershed was that moment for Egyptologists?
Well, this is a huge topic, and you only have me for a few minutes. I could talk forever on this. This is actually my period of specialty. I think, you know, there are a number of things going on with that. First of all, there's no tomb like that in ancient Egypt. It was a small tomb. King Tutankhamun was, you know, in the great sweep of ancient Egyptian history. I happen to think he was a very pivotal figure, but he only reigned for a decade. The mind boggles about what might have been in a tomb of a great king like Ramses II, but the fact is we have nothing like the stuff that came out of King Tut's tomb. This is the height of power and wealth and influence for ancient Egypt, so those artifacts are as good as they get. So that's one level. The other level is, from an archaeological point of view, that is an investigation into that tomb where a lot of things went right. It was the right person, a very meticulous scientist who documented everything he did. He understood the value of photography, the power of photography. He had a really good photographer working with him, and he spent 10 years cataloging all the stuff out of the tomb. So we actually, given the time period when Howard Carter, the lead archaeologist, was investigating that tomb, considering that time period, we have a great record of what he did and what he found.
I'm chatting with Ann R. Williams. She is the general editor of the brand new book, Treasures of Egypt, A Legacy in Photographs from the Pyramids to Cleopatra. It's a National Geographic project, and it is a fabulous read. The pictures are just stunning. Something, Anne, that I also took away from this is, and I guess I never think about it, is the Nile and how important that was for the Nile River, for ancient Egypt. Can you kind of explain where that fit into the economy, the culture of the time period?
Well, ancient Egypt, as I say, was the gift of the Nile. People in ancient Egypt were farmers. Ancient Egypt was an agricultural country, and they were able to be fabulously successful at that because of the annual cycle of the flooding of the Nile. When the rains came farther south in Ethiopia, they washed northward into the Nile, and there was a period after those rains when the Nile flooded its normal banks in Egypt. and then a period when the rain stopped in Ethiopia and the river went back to its riverbanks. But it dropped all of that rich volcanic silt on the fields of Egypt. And that meant that the fields were automatically fertilized. It also meant that the ancient Egyptian farmers could build structures to capture that water so that they could irrigate their fields. So you had this annual cycle of flooding and then planting and then harvesting, flooding, planting, harvesting. And it happened like clockwork for most of 3,000 years of ancient Egyptian history. And that was the basis of what allowed ancient Egypt to not only survive, but thrive.
It seems like, speaking of water, the boat building, and I guess I never thought about it. You just don't think about transportation at that time. But how advanced was the transportation that they used on the river?
Well, they had all sorts of boats. I mean, as you can imagine, so you have to imagine the map of Egypt. You have the Nile, and then you have the floodplain where you can cultivate, and then it's desert. So really, the Nile was the way that you got around. I mean, of course, there were trade routes, and people used mostly donkeys to get across those trade routes. And, you know, you could go from one village to the next. But if you really wanted to go distances, you had to travel on the Nile. And there were all sorts of crafts upon which you could do that. Everything from a really simple, almost reed canoe that people used to go hunting in the marshes, to great royal boats with many rowers to get the king from point A to point B. There were religious vessels that were used to transport statues of gods during festivals. I mean, you know, you have to imagine the Nile like a modern highway for automobiles. All of the cars that you see on the highway near where you live, that's what the Nile was like. It was full of boats of all different kinds.
I came across something in here, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It's P-U-N-T. Is it punt?
Punt, yes.
The story about, can you go through that story? Because it's so fascinating to me that nobody knows where this was.
Well, there, through the literature and through some reliefs on places like Queen Hatshepsut's mortuary temple at Deir el-Bahari, we know that Egypt traded through the Red Sea with some place to the south called Punt. And for many years, people did not know exactly where that was. Egypt traded with all of its neighbors. It was most especially interested in sub-Saharan Africa for a variety of things. Things like elephant ivory and leopard skins and a certain kind of tree from which they got very coveted resins. And for many years, there was a lot of discussion about where Punt might be. Very recently, there's a very smart scholar named Nate Dominey who had started to study baboons, the kind of baboons that are found in whose remains are found in archaeological contexts in Egypt. And he has figured out that those baboons came from the area around Yemen. And so that's probably where Punt was, because that's the only place that these baboons could have come from.
In your years of studying this, people making new discoveries and researching and scientific developments, has there been any watershed change in the thinking about ancient Egypt based upon something that an archaeologist has discovered that maybe changed the paradigm?
Well, I think the accumulation of evidence has given us a much clearer picture of how people lived and how dynasties came and went. And I think that now maybe this is my has more to do with my own journey through Egyptology, but I think, you know, very often when people start diving into Egyptology and they see 3,000 years and they see 30 dynasties and they think, you know, oh my goodness, that's a great sweep, and it was indeed, and traditions did carry on. But in fact, the politics of ancient Egypt were, I think, much more flexible. In other words, you had times when there was a very strong king. And then you had times when things were a little looser. You had a couple of people claiming that they were king. You had a capital in the north, capital in the south, power players in the middle, you know, and then a strong king would emerge and reunite everything. So there was more of a sort of a back and forth between times when there was a very strong king and times when things were a little more chaotic.
The pyramids themselves, I think they're so iconic as far as what we think, but I think that people think, oh, the pyramids, a wonder of the world, and that's all there was. What is the significance of the pyramids other than a really cool tourist thing?
Oh, well, pyramids are, well, they're a couple of things. I mean, you could think about them as a stairway to heaven and a metaphor for the sun's rays shining down upon the king and all of us. You have to remember that the pyramids didn't look in antiquity the way they look now. They were not, I mean, yeah, they're big, and they were the biggest thing anybody has seen back then. But they were covered in brilliant white limestone, so they must have been very blinding to anybody in the neighborhood. The other thing that they are is very symbolic of the agricultural cycle in ancient Egypt. In other words, when the Nile floods started to dissipate, you have to imagine that when the floodwaters started to shrink, you start to see one little bit of land emerging from these receding waters. And that is the hope that the waters will recede indeed, and you will have your fields back, and you will be able to plant them again. But that one little bit of water, that one little bit of land, was connected in the ancient Egyptian mind to the primordial mound that was the first bit of land to emerge from the primordial chaos. And so that had to do with the creation of everything, the creation of ancient Egypt and the creation of the world and the creation of everything that we see. So that pyramid was a symbol of this primordial mound. And when you go down inside, down into the roots of the Step Pyramid at Giza, for instance, there are corridors that were tiled in aquamarine colored tiles as a nod to this primordial mound emerging from the chaos of the creation of the world.
Among
pretty deep, huh?
It is. And you know, and I'm thinking to myself, as there's, you know, you're not the only Egyptologist. Are there genuine intellectual disagreements among Egyptologists about certain aspects of ancient Egypt based upon some of the science now?
Oh, yes. Everybody discusses everything all the time. Everybody has different opinions. It's all part of the scientific process. Somebody will come up with an idea, they'll present evidence, and, you know, and then there's a discussion. The really great thing about technology now is that it allows us to do these discussions very quickly and to share information and share site reports and 3D models of artifacts that have been found so that everybody can join in the discussion very easily.
Well, this book is just fascinating. The photographs and the text that goes with it to try to explain all of this stuff is just, I mean, it's mind-boggling how somebody could put all this together, but you have certainly done it. She is Ann R. Williams, the general editor of the book Treasures of Egypt, A Legacy in Photographs from the Pyramids to Cleopatra. It's a Nat Geo book. It is available everywhere. Go out and pick one up, and believe me, you will be paging through this night after night after night, as I was. And just a fantastic piece of literature you put together here in photographs, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Yeah.